tonight from the Baldwin Group to share with us his experience. We have Roy.
Hi everyone, I'm an alcoholic, my name's Roy. I haven't had a drink today, for which I'm really grateful, and a number of other people are grateful too. And by the grace of a power greater than myself, which has come into my life, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since the 22nd of April 1990, and for that I'm really grateful. I was having dinner with Phil earlier, and I said, I got a real resentment, because the last time this group invited me to speak, they gave me like 4 weeks to do 12 steps. So that's like 3 steps. And now you tell me to do 12 steps in one meeting. And then being the kind of alcoholic I am, I had to kind of calculate, so that worked out to 5 minutes a step. That's really not fair. And of course, we had a laugh about that. But again, I'm an alcoholic, and like I said, I stopped drinking on the 22nd of April 1990. But I actually recovered from my alcoholism about a year later. So for about a year, I had done the steps, and I was still more or less an active dry drunk. I'm not going to talk too much about my war story, because I figure most of you sitting over here have an advanced education in how to get drunk and how to stay drunk. And if all you're here for tonight is a cup of coffee and a couple of cookies, you can get a much better deal at Dunkin' Donuts, 7-Eleven, or one of those other places. So if you're here, you're probably here because you have the same problem I have, and that is how to not drink again. Because I still don't have the power to not drink. My drinking story is really pretty simple. I learned to drink, I got drunk, and I stayed drunk. And that was it. And along the way, I went through 4 jobs, a broken engagement, 2 or 3 allegedly meaningful relationships, a career change, an enlarged liver, and a motorcycle accident which almost left me for dead. Yes, I know I don't look like a biker, but I used to be a biker. I still have a bike, it's a bicycle, and my wife's sitting there, and that's all she'll allow me to ride on 2 wheels now. As you probably figured out from my accent by now, I'm not from around here. And I am from India. I did most of my drinking in India, and I got sober in India. I just want to do a brief historical as to how I actually got to be here tonight, because in 1940, a group of American pilots, before America entered the Second World War, a group of American pilots volunteered with the Canadians, and they formed a group called the Flying Tigers. And the Canadian Air Force sent them to India, and they were flying out of Calcutta, and they were fighting the Japanese at that time. This is before Pearl Harbor. And these Americans started the first AA meeting at Calcutta Airport, and there was one Indian that got sober. And when the war was over, the Americans went home, and history lost track of that Indian guy, and AA didn't survive. In 1957, a Canadian diplomat called Charlie M. Was transferred to India. So he wrote to the GSO office and said, send me a list of meetings in India. And now legend has it that they sent him a big book and said, pass it on. What actually happened was they wrote him a letter and said, here are the names of 2 social workers in New Delhi who've made some inquiries, and they might be able to help you. So Charlie comes to India, and he spends 2 or 3 months presenting his credentials and forgetting about didn't really bother about AA or anything. And 2 or 3 months later, he saw this drunk being mercilessly ejected from a hotel. And he started to tell the guys, don't you know, he's an alcoholic, he's a sick man. And he said, Arey sir, please, he will just steal your money. So that being established, listen, I can get away with doing that. I'm from India. that being established, Charlie was overcome with guilt, and he took out an advertisement in every leading English newspaper, which basically said, "Do you have a drinking problem? Do you want to stop?" And a schoolmaster in Bombay, which is now called Mumbai, the late Harry M., replied to this ad, and Charlie lent him the car fare. He went by train to New Delhi. This is a 2,000 mile journey. Stayed at the Canadian embassy for a couple of weeks. Did the steps and went back to Bombay. In Harry 12-stepped Ignatius P., the two of them 12-stepped John G., and the three of them 12-stepped Tony M., and they got the nucleus of the first group. This was in 1957. Separately, another guy, an Anglo-Indian brigadier general in the army, read this ad while he was up in the mountains in the Himalayas, fighting one of our eternal wars against the Pakistanis or the Chinese or whoever we were fighting at that time. And Trevor Kay wrote to Charlie. And Charlie sent him back a big book, and he sponsored Trevor through the mail. And Trevor never actually met his sponsor, Charlie, for 5 months. And 5 months later, when he went to New Delhi, he actually took his fifth step. Now, you want proof? If you have a third edition of the big book, his story is there. It's called Life Saving Words. And so that's how AA came to India. And you know, the message spread slowly over a number of years. I grew up Western oriented in India. My parents were both dental surgeons. My first language is English. I think in English, which means when I speak Indian languages, my brothers make fun of me. But growing up at home, we grew up around alcohol. And, you know, there were parties every Saturday night. There'd be singing around the piano. And, you know, I saw a lot of alcohol being used, and, you know, laughter and good times. And I never really saw alcoholism. It was accepted. My grandmother had this batch of children's wine, which she would have for these kids. It was okay to give kids wine back in the 60s. It was probably about 1% alcohol, 99% grape juice, but that was it. And then as soon as we got into double digits, we got graduated to this concoction called Shandy, which the bloody Brits left behind. And you took about an inch and a half of beer, and you topped up the glass with lemonade, and it was okay to give kids that as well. So that's how I grew up around alcohol. The only alcoholism I saw, which I now know to be alcoholism, was my grandmother's brother. This guy was cool. He'd come early for the parties. He'd always have his little bag over his shoulder. He'd come straight into the back room, and he'd hang out with us kids. He'd listen to us. He'd tell these amazing stories, you know, things that had happened to him. And, you know, he'd always give us money and send us out to get cigarettes and peanuts. And he was one of those keep the change kind of fellas. But the reason we kids loved him, he could be counted on to do something spectacular every time. Head first into the cake. Break a bottle of my dad's best scotch, you know, something like that. And then we wouldn't see him for 2 or 3 months. But he was kind, and he was funny, and he had time for us kids, and, you know, and he had such adventures. And I wish I could be like him when I grew up. Guess what? I got my wish. For him, the story didn't end happily. He never went to AA, and coming home from work one night, he fell, hit his head on the curb, and died. And so he never made it into recovery. And my introduction to AA was when I was 17 or 18. I was reading a book called The Second Deadly Sin. It was about this New York City detective who was chasing the ice pick killer. And somewhere in the story, and the detective's in AA, and somewhere in the story he's having a slip. So he's having this argument with his lieutenant. And he said, "You should go back to AA." And they said, "No, you can't go back there once you started drinking." Of course, I kept that bit of information. But they were talking about the disease of alcoholism, and I felt so uncomfortable, I just fast-forwarded those pages and moved on. I was 21 or 22, 1984. I was 6 o'clock in the morning, and I was drinking. And my grandmother was coming back from church and said, "Are you an alcoholic? Drinking at 6 in the morning?" And, you know, I was shocked. I went into this long, convoluted explanation as to how people who work night shifts are supposed to come home and have 2 or 3 drinks so you can sleep through the noise of the traffic and, you know, be able to wake up fresh and go to work. And she wouldn't have anything of that. But I remember the day I got into serious drinking. It was the day I finished high school. three of us went out hiking, and now that we were real men, we went to the nearest liquor store and picked up a couple of bottles of beer. And in India, you don't need ID to buy anything. And we get to the top of this mountain, you know, hot and sweaty, and none of us Einsteins had brought an opener along, but you know, after fiddling around with stones and twigs and stuff like that, we got the bottle open. It was flat and warm, and you know, I had the first swig, and it tasted disgusting. And my mind, I'm saying, I can't figure out what grown-ups see in this stuff. You know, for a kid who's only drunk his grandmother's sweet homemade wine and lemonade sweetened beer for the last 10 years, the real thing was really nasty. But I didn't want to let the other two guys out. Wow, this is great, pass it on. And the other two guys were as big liars as I was, because they swore it was good too. I know, I learned later that what I had just experienced was the effect of alcohol, because 20 seconds later it hit me and I felt great, and all of a sudden the tiredness went away, the view from the mountain was great, the breeze was cool, it was refreshing, and I don't know who suggested it, but I volunteered to climb back down that mountain and get some more, and I did. And I came back with a bottle of rum, and I had my first blackout that weekend. Don't remember very much more. I know there was some vomiting because the evidence went home on my clothes. I know there was some fighting because some of my clothes were torn and I had some unaccounted bruises on my body. Somebody's shirt got burnt in the campfire. I know that one. And one of those two guys is still not talking to me. And this was December 1st, 1977. And then I did what most kids in India my age do. You go back, your parents send you to college, and you spend Monday to Friday, you know, making plans for Friday to Sunday, and you scrounge whatever money you can, and you get whatever you can, whether it's liquid or not, and you put it into your body, and you know, you have a blast. And I always wore it like a badge of honor that I was the guy that could drink the most and do the most and make sure everyone got home safe. And Monday morning, we'd all get together on the basketball court in college and piece together pieces of our story to figure out what we did. So it took me 3 years to get through 1 year of a college education, and then the college said that they could exist without my meager contributions. Show them. Who do they think that I need a college education? I show them. So I started working full time, and you know, that's when I went through my drinking story. 4 jars, broke engagement, blah, 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 blah. And the second time I was told about AA, I'm sorry, that the first time when my grandmother said this, and I said, and she said you're an alcoholic, and you need to go and meet your Uncle Tony and his friends who don't drink. You know, when you're 21, you don't want to go and hang out with your grandmother's brother Tony and his friends that don't drink. But if you love your grandmother as much as I did, you have a few drinks and you go. Now, Uncle Tony very wisely stayed away from the proceedings. But I went to what I now know was an AA meeting, and there was a bunch of people there. And they're all very old, you know. I was younger than them. I was better looking than them. I was smarter than them. You know, and life was great. But I sat there, humored them. I didn't know what they said. I didn't hear anything. Most people didn't have phones, so they gave me the meeting list. There were like 12 meetings in the whole city. This was 1984. And I keep coming back, and I said, see ya. And 2 years later, or 3 years later, I had this enlarged liver. And my brother's girlfriend said, you're an alcoholic. You need to go to AA. And I said, why don't you take your pop? He has a bigger problem than I have. But I did go. And you know, between 84 and 1990, I kind of went to AA a few times. I never went sober. You know, so I never really knew what they were saying. And then finally, after this motorcycle accident, you know, I kind of had a moment of clarity. And I woke up one morning and I couldn't stop drinking again. And I decided to kill myself, so I climbed up on the ledge to jump. And to give you an indication of how much my alcoholism had progressed, my younger brother said, jump, you bastard, and put us out of this misery. And I would have jumped, but the phone rang. And, you know, I don't know about here, but alcoholics in India, they buy lotto tickets, you know, just in case you win. And I said, well, maybe I've won. So I don't want to jump and die and leave my winnings to these people. So I climbed off the ledge, and by the grace of God, it was my brother's girlfriend, the same girl who tried to get me to go a couple of years earlier. And she'd been living with an alcoholic father for years. So she grabbed a bottle of rum, came over to my house, poured me a good stiff drink. So what's the problem? I don't have a job. And she said, well, stop drinking and you'll get a job. I never went to college. Stop drinking and go to the, I don't have a girlfriend. Stop drinking. You're a nice guy. You'll get a girl. Whatever I said, she said, stop drinking. And from deep within me came the truth. I can't stop. That was my first introduction to the first step. I admit it. I can't stop. So she said, okay, we'll get you to AA. I said, it doesn't work. I've never been sober, but I've been going for years. It doesn't work. By the grace of God, the first hospital meeting in AA had just started up. And the next morning was a Saturday. And I went for my first meeting sober. I didn't know it was a meeting. You know, I said, take me to a doctor and get me a prescription for hand abuse. I was well read. I knew what was out there. And so 8 o'clock in the morning, I was in a room very much like this. You know, I thought, wow, this doctor must be really good. 8 o'clock, this many people here to stop drinking. And some fool got up here and started saying, Alcoholics Anonymous, the College of Brother. I'd like to tell you that because I was well brought up, I sat down and I listened to the message. I was stuck in a corner. There was a 300-pound guy on one side of me. My mom was on the other side of me. And the nearest exit was, I couldn't even see where the nearest exit was. So I sat and listened, you know, and it was a 5-speaker meeting. 1 hour, 5 speakers. I couldn't identify with the first 4 speakers. They'd been to jail. I'd never been to jail. Yeah, I got arrested every Saturday night and, you know, they'd leave. But it wasn't jail. It was like lockup. You know, it was like, it was sleeping it off kind of stuff. And, you know, and they'd been divorced. I'd never been divorced. Heck, I hadn't even been married. Yeah. Encounters, but you know, and they had lost jobs, and I never lost jobs, I'd quit before they could fire me. So I wasn't like them. But the last guy that spoke, the late Horace H., may his soul rest in peace, he talked about the disease of alcoholism, and I had no problem identifying, you know. He talked about a guy called Dr. Silkworth, and he said Dr. Silkworth's opinion is that alcoholism is an illness, it's progressive, and it kills alcoholics. What do you mean? And he said, well, it's characterized by a physical craving and a mental obsession and a spiritual bankruptcy. And I said, I mean, I didn't say that because I'm sitting in the meeting. And he says, the physical craving is manifested in an allergy. Something is different about an alcoholic's body, that when he has a drink, his body demands more. He can say he's going to have 2 drinks. But his body demands more. And he said, that explains my drinking. I was the guy that always said 2 drinks before dinner, darling. And darling saw plenty of dinners. I never stopped at 2 drinks. You know, I was the guy that always said, no, nightcap and 1 for the road. And that explained my drinking. I swore that I was only going to have 2 drinks tonight. Never happened. So I said, yeah, I can identify with that. And then he talked about a mental obsession so powerful that would overcome both the desire and the necessity to stop, to stay sober. And I had no problem identifying with that as well. When I had the enlarged liver, it was necessary for me to stay sober. When I had the motorcycle accident, it was pretty bad. I was in a coma for 7 days. I got 36 stitches in my head. I have 8 compressed vertebrae in my back and neck. I was in a neck collar for 6 months. And I was a back brace for, you know. And the doctor said, it is necessary for you, Mr. T, that you stay in this hospital and take rest. And all of a sudden, I was like the second coming of Mahatma Gandhi. No, there are people dying out there on the streets. You put them in hospital. Now, what was really happening was, I was experiencing alcoholism, but I didn't know it. Because I woke up out of that coma, and the first emotion I experienced was fear. Oh my God, where am I? What happened? And then they told me what happened. Oh, you want the bike? Can you crash the bike like a good alcoholic? I quickly invented a story. I said, oh, there was this cow crossing the road. Later on, I found out there were no cows in that particular village. There were plenty of pigs and dogs and people, but no cows. But when they told me, you know, I was supposed to be working. I was in the film business by that time. And then I was full of shame, you know. How could I have done it? I who pride myself so well on my control. How could I have lost control and crashed a bike? I've been riding for so many years. And guilt. I shouldn't have been drinking. I should have been out there working and doing stuff. And then remorse. Man, why did I do this? Shame and fear and guilt and remorse. And I started getting really restless in this hospital bed because whatever they were pumping into me wasn't working. And then I started getting really irritable because, you know, what the heck? You know, I'm stuck over here. And then I got really discontented and I said, let me out of here. I took a discharge against medical advice. Crossed the road, had a couple of drinks, rented another motorcycle. I didn't need a helmet anymore. I had this big bloody bandage on my head. And I rode back to the film unit. And when Horace was speaking, he was talking about all these things. A mental obsession so powerful that would overcome both the desire and the necessity to stay sober. I love that tune, whoever's it is. Cell phones don't bother me at all. If cell phones in meetings don't bother me at all. I just think of the number of people I kept awake at nights with a racket I made while I was out there drunk. And you're, go ahead, take the call. Take it outside. So these emotions took me out there. And Horace explained that. I said, yeah. And then he talked about a spiritual illness. He said the lying and the cheating, you know, and the stuff that you do in order to keep your disease alive. And I thought about that. Lying. I lied to every boss, every girlfriend, every employer, every family member, anyone who asked me anything. I lied first while I was thinking about whether I told the truth or not. Cheating. I've never given an employer 40 hours a week. Especially when I was out there. Coming late, hungover, spend the first 2 hours of the day grabbing a file and then walking around from office to office, pretending you're going somewhere to do something and hoping no one will ask you a question which demands an intelligent reply. That was me. Spend my lunch break, extended lunch break, usually drink my lunch. And then the early part of the evening, making plans for the rest of the evening. Never gave them 40 hours. So I said, wow, okay, I'm in. Where can I get the prescription? And they pointed to these steps. And I looked at these steps and I said, powerless? No. I'm not powerless, I'm 28. I quit using other stuff, booze I can stop. Unmanageable, I had to admit that. You know, I was broke, I was homeless, I was single, I had no money, I was living with my grandmother. Unmanageable. I'm not insane, you guys are nuts. Step 3, I don't believe in God, so that's out. Step 4, I'm perfect, so that's out. Step 5 is God, so that's out. Step 6, I'm still perfect, so that's out. 7's out, 8. You guys need some help with 8. I would rewrite 8, I can make a long list of people I'd like to harm. And they said, Roy, we have a step for that, it's called 4. And then I said, yeah, 9, you guys need some help with 9 because I have a long list of people that owe me. And then 10, of course, is out, and 11 has God, so that's out, and 12, yeah, I'd be quite happy to let people know about your little club. So that was the 18th of February, 1990. And needless to say, I'm not the poster child for AA. I did not stay sober from day one. I stayed sober a week, and then I slipped. And then I came back. And they're all sitting over there, and they said, are you ready for step 2? I said, nah, I don't need those steps. And I stayed sober 2 weeks, and then I slipped again. And I was out for almost a month, lost another job in the process. And that was really terrible, to lose a job after coming to AA. And And then I came back to AA and I stayed sober 3 weeks. And then I drank again. And that was my last drink, 22nd of April 1990. You know what the worst part of all that? The worst part was not the slipping and the coming back. The worst part was that all those old timers were still sitting over there, they were still smiling, and they were still all annoyingly sober. None of them had slipped. But I had my moment of truth, 22nd of April, and I had to ask myself, why did you drink? You know, why did you drink? What was my first step experience over there? You know, I tried to drink in control and I couldn't. I tried to quit and I couldn't. I quit every Monday, sometimes even till Tuesday. But so I wasn't able to stop. I wasn't able to control. I tried many things and it didn't work. And deep down inside me, I admitted, not that I was an alcoholic, I admitted that. I admitted I was powerless. I did not have the power to stay sober. And I came back to to the meeting, and one of the wisest guys has said probably the most spiritual thing I've ever heard in AA. You know, sometimes in AA, it's very kind to take an unpopular position. And this guy took an unpopular position. What he said to me is, I think it's time you got your head out of your ass and started following directions. And I said, how do I do that? He said, find a sponsor. And I did. And I found this sponsor. And he took me, his name was Franco, see. And he took me through the first 3 steps in the first 10 minutes that I met him. He said, why have you stopped drinking? And I looked at him he had 2 heads. I said, why? Because I can't anymore. If there was some way I could drink, I wouldn't be here. I've tried before AA, after AA, I've tried every which way. I can't drink anymore. I can't drink in control. I can't stop when I want to. I said, okay, that sounds like a pretty good admission of powerlessness. I said, where are you working? Unemployed again. And what does your girlfriend say? I'm single again. Where are you living? My grandmother. Got any money? $3 in the bank. I said, yeah, your life's pretty unmanageable. Your first step's done. And he said, so, do you believe in God? And I said, no. He said, why are you asking me to sponsor you? I said, I heard you speak the last time I was sober. You got sober when you were 20 and you now have 16 years. You obviously know how to do this stuff. So he said, would you concede that where alcohol is concerned, I'm a power greater than you because I know how to do this and you don't? I said, yeah, I'll concede that. He said, okay. The second step is done. You admit that you're willing to believe that there's a power greater than yourself. Would you agree that the stuff you did was pretty crazy? I said, yeah. He said, I haven't done any crazy stuff for 16 years. So if you want me to sponsor you, I could restore you to some sanity. I said, okay, good. Your second step's done. He said, are you willing to do anything I ask you to do? I thought about that. He said, this is the deal. You want me to sponsor you? Yes or no? I said, I'm willing to do anything you ask me to do. He said, good. You've just done your third step. And that was it. Step 1, 2, and 3. So he said, okay, so you don't believe in God, kneel down. The meeting's over, people are hanging around, so we knelt down there. And he said, repeat after me. If there is a God, please keep me sober today. So I said that, we got up. And he said, if you're still sober when you get home tonight, say, if there's a God, thank you. And you keep doing that, and one day you may or may not come to believe. But you know what? It's better than not drinking. So I said I would do whatever he asked me to do. So we crossed the road, we bought a 200-page notebook, and he said, start your first step, your fourth step. And this was my first day back, 22nd of April, 1990. So he turned to page 1 and write, I am a liar. So that started a 1 week, I'm not a liar, I'm many things. But so he asked me to write this. He got sponsored old-style AA, and he asked me to write the story of my life. Here I was, another Hemingway in the making. Go back 2 pages. I missed a comma over there. Maybe there should be an exclamation point. Tear off those last 2 pages and do a rewrite. What will he think of me if he reads this? Anyway, I didn't finish this in a week because I don't know about you guys on 4th step. I did 2 days, then I'd goof off for 3 or 4 days. It took me 3 or 4 months. And I say, if there's a God. And finally we got together. I was done. He came over to my house. He sat down and he took my fourth step. And now this guy got sponsored by the old timers, and this is how he did it, and this is how he sponsored me. And how we did the fifth step was, he sat down with my fourth step and started reading it. And I'm sitting on the edge of my seat across the room, and I'm watching him, and he's reading my book, his eyebrows are going up, he's making these sounds, he's shaking his head, he's in... And what was the most disconcerting part, he had this piece of paper at the side and he kept making notes on that. This is terrible. It took a couple of hours to get through this. I'm sweating bullets by this time. And he finished and he said, okay, he handed me this paper. And he said, once, maybe one or two papers, I'm not sure, but it was a list of my defects of character which he had picked out of my story. And on the other side, on the other page, was a list of amends which he said I had to make. There was no choice. Remember, I said I would do anything he asked. He said, these are the amends. I said, well, my grandmother lives in Australia. I don't care. Start saving. But my sister lives in America. If you save enough, you can do it on the same trip. He probably thought I was going to take a boat or something, because he worked at the docks, you know, he worked on ships. Anyway, so that was my fourth and fifth, and then we burnt my fourth step in my barbecue pit, and you know, he said, now you have a new prayer. You take all these defects of character and you say, if there is a God, while you're keeping me sober, please remove all these defects. Can't I keep some? All. Oh, okay. So that was my sixth and seventh. I started doing my amends. You know, I'm so glad my friend sitting there right at the back. And I have learned more about making amends from... my friend Brian than anybody I've met in the last 19 years. And you know, amends were hard to make, they were difficult to make, but my sponsor would come with me. He'd come with me and say, okay, you gotta pay this guy back, let's go. Can we do it tomorrow? Now. I only got $10. Okay, so tell him you got $10 and he'll pay $10 a week for the next 500 weeks or however long it is. And hopefully you'll get a better job and then you can make it $20 a week. So, around this time, I had two experiences in which the doubt was removed and I came to believe. My worst enemy was dying of cancer in the hospital. And if he had died, I was going to throw a party. And he was there moaning and groaning, and I said, if there is a God, you can make this man well. If not, take away the pain. And this guy woke up the next day pain-free. He was pain-free for the next 2 or 3 days, and the doctors were going to discharge him. And he was due to be discharged the next morning, and he went to sleep that night, and he never woke up. I said, whoa! I dropped the word if from my prayers instantly. And a little after that, I had a spiritual experience where I was sitting in a restaurant with somebody and I felt like drinking. My hand went out for the bottle. There's nothing left in it. I can't explain it, but some power propelled me out of that restaurant, and I was standing on the side of the road. Traffic. You know, India, we have a lot of people. 6 o'clock in the evening. Traffic and noise and all this stuff, and everything went black. And like a sheet of lightning went through the center of my head, the desire to drink or use anything else was removed from me at that day. I did my amends to the best I could. You know, I did 10 steps and 11 steps. I had a lot of fun with the 12 steps. And then a year later, I was ready to kill myself. I finished my 1 year and I said to Franco, I'm going to retire from AA. He said, why? I said, because I still don't feel any different. I'm still angry and upset and frightened. And is this it? Is this sobriety? Going for meetings? And it was really not helpful to me, because I was 28. And I was like the youngest person in the country sober at that time. So every time I went for, young blood, get Roy to speak. Bad for my ego. 2 seconds before coming into AA meeting, I would put on my AA face. Hey Roy, how's it going? Great. One day at a time. Let go, let God. But inside, oh my God, I'm still not making enough money. The chicks don't like me. I'm not getting a good job. So I said, you know what, I've had enough of AA. I'll come back once a month to show you guys that I'm still sober. By the grace of God, my sister who lived in San Francisco at the time sent me my own copy of the Big Book. And my aunt who lived in Melbourne sent me these two Americans who were sharing the experiences of the Big Book on tape, Joe and Charlie. And I started listening to that, and that changed my life and it changed my recovery. And I recovered after doing those steps. And it was pretty awesome. I started doing the steps again as outlined in the book. Follow directions. It's written to show people like me, not to tell, but to show people like me precisely how they, the first 100, recovered. So this was offered. If I wanted to do that, I could do that, or else I could keep drinking. So I started doing those steps. And, you know, what for me was real liberation was step two. My own concept of God, however inadequate, was sufficient. That was great news for me. You know, I had a problem with the concept of God. Franco said, is there anyone you like? Yeah, I like so and so. Why? Oh, he's a nice guy. You know, he's kind. Write it down. And generous. He's loving and he's forgiving. And I had this whole paper full of characteristics of people that I admired. And he said, if you had to pick a God, wouldn't you like God to be like this? I said, yeah. He said, well, that can be your concept. And I said, it was that simple. I said, wow. And then the third step, I hadn't really understood the third step. You know, I was just, yeah, I've given my will and life to God, but I didn't know what it meant. But when I sat down with the Big Book and I, you know, my life is a series of actions based on my will. What is my will? My will is my insane thinking. My will tells me there must be some way, somehow, someday that I'm going to be able to control and enjoy my drinking. And that's where my will takes me. And based on that, I keep doing all kinds of things to harm people. And the program says I need to turn my thinking and my actions over to the care of God. The rest of my life for today, I don't know if I'll be alive tomorrow. Oh, that's pretty easy. The best part about the third step prayer, take away my difficulties. Okay, God, the mortgage, my boss, the person who doesn't like me. And I love that prayer. It's not just take my will and life, take away my difficulties. Not my problem anymore. And then the question, I thought well before taking the step. Am I ready to abandon myself utterly to God? Does he want me to be broke? Is he going to... I don't know. Well, how well did you do when you won your own power, Roy? Not really that good. Well, at least if you give your will and life over to God, it won't be in the hands of a complete idiot. Yes, Franco, that's some consolation. So let's do the fourth step now. So I read, the next thing in the book said, next. I was hoping it would say, like, take a break for a month. Take 3 years, do your fourth step in the front. It says, next. And it said, if I don't do this at once, you know, I'm not going to have lasting sobriety. I love the Big Book because it had a really simple outline. Whom am I pissed off at? I think they use the word angry. For example. Whom would I like to kill? Boom, 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 boom. Why? Because they did this. What got affected? My self-esteem. My security. My ambitions. My personal relation with sex. Yeah, that's pretty easy. I know whom I'm pissed off at right now. I can give you a list right now. Good, start writing. Oh. I'm done. No, you're not. I'm not? No, now you need to start praying for these people. How do I pray? There's a nice thing on page 552. Ask for their health and their prosperity and their happiness. What will I get out of that? Nothing. The resentment might go away and you can drop them off the list. Okay, now I'm done. No, you're not. Now what? Turn back to the list and see what you did to them. Oh, what did I do to him? He hit on my wife. I hit on his wife. Was it selfish? Was it Zanus? Was it self-seeking? Was there fear? Okay, now I'm done. Now what? Now fear inventory. I'm not afraid of anything. Oh, you're not? No, what about snakes? Only cobras. Okay. What about failure, Roy? Cheap shot. Of course I'm afraid of failure. What about growing old alone? Okay, I got some fears. Is there anything you're not afraid of? What do I do with these fears? We ask God to remove them. That's it. Okay, now I'm done. Sex inventory. Listen, you know, I thought I was like a Don Juan. By the time I finished my sex inventory, I came out looking like Elmer Fudd. And let me tell you, I was single when I got sober, and you know, I was a pretty active dater. I dated 3 women till I met Diana, and 2 of them I dated twice. So it wasn't a long inventory. I said, okay, now I'm done. He said, one last inventory. The people you've harmed. My grandmother never got on any of my lists. I wasn't resentful at her. I wasn't afraid of her. Thank God I never had sex with her. But I did steal from her. And these were people I had harmed. So she got onto that list. And off I was to make those amends. I got my list of amends from the 4th. I got my list of defects from the 4th. And I started doing that. It's been such an adventure. I just want to share on a couple of 12-step experiences that I've had. The first 12-step call I went on was the very first day that I came back. The day that I came back, they said, okay, young man, they actually used some different words, but out of respect for them. They said, you want to see what happens to people who keep drinking? And they took me on a 12-step call. I'm so wet behind the ears. You know, my first day back, this guy just made me kneel down in front of 20 people, you know, and give me some book. I have to start writing stuff. And then they take me out to see this guy called, Grant Road Tory. And this guy had been sober for 10 years and then went out, and he was in his 12th year of relapse. So they go and they knock on the door. Tony opens the door, whiskey glass in hand, and they say, hey, Tony, here's a new guy. It's his first day in AA. We brought him to show you what happens to people who don't stop drinking. These are hardcore AA guys. Tony immediately goes into recovery mode. He throws out his booze and he starts trying to 12-step me and tell me why I shouldn't be doing what he's doing. And we ended that night taking him to the hospital and admitting him. And he got sober, and then he died sober 3 or 4 years later. That was my first 12-step call. I hated my sponsor, Franco, because, I had a car and I had a motorbike, and, you know, he was a guy that took 2 buses and a train. He said, oh, Roy, what are you doing tomorrow morning at 5 o'clock? And I'd say, sleeping. He's saying, no, you're meeting me at so-and-so corner because you're going on a 12-step call. And I've had some wonderful experiences, almost like things you read in the big book, where we'd go and knock on someone's door at 5 in the morning. Who are you? I'm Roy. I'm Franco. We are from this company, AA. The liquor store owner has complained that you're drinking too much. We'd invent all... The cops have complained. The liquor store has complained. And we'd go there, we'd tell our stories, and we'd take the guy to the meeting and hope to try and get him into the steps. And when I was about 3 years sober, I got my job back in the film business after I got sober. And when I was 3 years sober, we were doing a documentary film for UNICEF, for the United Nations. And we went around India on a bus. And in 6 months, we passed through only 2 towns that had an AA meeting. So in 1993, the internet had not yet been invented. And cell phones hadn't reached India. Thank God I wasn't one of those make a meeting every day in order. Thank God it got into the program. So I took my big book with me. I took a whole bunch of pamphlets in different languages and I took a stack of letters. So every day we'd set up the film shoot, and once the shoot started, I'd be wandering around the village trying to find, randomly trying to 12-step people, whether they were drinking or not. I said, they're down. Alcoholism is a disease. I know there are people in this village that are dying, and I'd leave this literature. And then when the guy wakes up, or if he ever comes back, translate this, give it to him. And I try and find people that could read and write and explain the concept to the guys. And every night I'd write a letter to somebody in recovery. That was my meeting, because part of my job was to make sure there was enough booze for the film crew to drink. Part of my job was dragging the bodies off to bed, and part of my job was getting them to work the next day. That was great. And I didn't drink in those 6 months. I did stay sober. And that was such a great, a blessed experience. That was a blessed experience. I don't know if anybody ever got sober, but I stayed sober. Another experience I had, I was about 5 years sober, and God sent me to a country out in the Middle East where drinking is taboo. You're not allowed to drink. It's against the state and the religion. There's actually only one liquor store. That's very funny, because there's only one liquor store in the entire country, and that's owned by the Sheikh. But but the rest of the country was dry. And you know, if you're a foreigner, you were given a permit to have alcohol. So I had to go to the next country for meetings twice a week. And then 2 or 3 months later, another guy came into the country I was living in, and we opened a chapter 7 and we followed the directions and we started a meeting. We found a place and we let people know, and every Tuesday Mark and I would go to the meeting. You again? Who did you expect? Charlie Brown? Here I am. And I'd tell him my story and he'd tell me his story, and we'd drive the U.S. Embassy mad. We'd keep calling the U.S. Embassy. Hi, this is Roy. Are there any American warships in the area? Sir, that's classified information. You don't understand. We are from AA. We know there are sailors on that ship that need to... Sir, that's classified information. So like good alcoholics, we left the U.S. Embassy alone and we did the next best thing. We went and talked to all the hookers and all the pimps, and they let us know what to do. Boys went down. Now, and then we'd go down to the, you know, I'm sorry this offends anybody, but it's my experience. And we'd go down to the docks, Mark and myself, and we'd have this little signboard, any friends of Bill W. on board, and we'd take 2 or 3 U.S. sailors captive, the poor guys, and drag them off. These guys have been on ship for 6 months. They think they're going to a meeting. We take them to this room. We put 3 of them up there, and 2 of us sit there and say, you're the meeting. We need to listen. I had a spiritual experience a few years ago. I was speaking at the Hicksville group, and a guy came up to me after I spoke, and he was crying, and he was one of those sailors that I had picked up in 1995 and taken to that meeting. You know, my hair standing again now, just recounting this. That's a spiritual experience. I haven't experienced any bells and whistles after that one experience, but that to me is a spiritual experience. And I came over here, and you know, I was sober for and after being here for a year, my sponsor said, "Oh, we're going to Akron, Ohio." I said, "I've already been, and I'm broke, so I'm not going." He said, "I'm paying, and you're going." I said, "Okay, that's an offer I can't refuse." So I got on that bus, full of alcoholics, and I saw this one young lady sitting in front, and you know, I was attracted to her, and she didn't even remember me the next weekend. Terrible. And then for the next two or three months, I was kind of hanging around a home group, you know, trying to find out if anything's going to happen over here. And I wasn't sure. I said, "God, give me a sign." And these two guys who had originally 12-stepped me, Joe and Charlie, were actually in Manhattan, and they're doing a big book study at the hotel next to the old World Trade Center. And I go over there, and this young lady walks out. Oh, she's into the big book. This I gotta pursue. We got married a year later, and we're still married. We have a son who's in... He thinks he's in recovery, because when you're doing sober countdowns, anyone with 7 years and he'll stand up. We had to change the rules now. When we bring him to meetings, he can only come if he watches a movie with his headphones on, so he doesn't hear some of the stuff that we talk about. Sobriety's fun. What's it like now? I wake up every morning, I keep hitting the snooze button, so I do step 1, 2 and 3, 7 and 11 in the shower. My step 1 and 2 is very simple. Every morning I say, "God, please keep me sober today." By saying, "Please keep me sober," I'm acknowledging 18 years and 11 months later that I'm as powerless today as I was that time. By asking God to keep me sober, I'm acknowledging step 2, that a power greater than myself can restore me to sane thinking. And then I do my third step in the shower, which is, shower's on, God relieve me of the bondage of money, power, sex and fame, and take away my difficulties, the mortgage and my boss and the jerk down the block and whoever else, and my seventh step. All of me, good and bad. I don't really say it that way. I usually sing all of me, and I'm not going to do that now. And then I'm out of the shower, and I'm doing my 11th step while I'm walking to the Baldwin station. I love the 11th step. We consider our plans for the day. What am I going to do today? Okay, I got to go there. I got to send out 3 resumes. I got to call Phil and remind him that he's treating me to dinner tonight. But that's really it. And when I first got sober, I would write that down, and now I remember some of it. And I hate the 10th step. I hated it then, I hate it now, because it forces me to be accountable throughout the day. Can I share that? I just learned 2 weeks ago that, my company is closing down my division and I'm going to be unemployed at the end of this month. Third step. You can have all of me giving myself utterly to him. Is this what you want now? Okay. God, as I don't understand him sometimes. So everybody in the company is worried. We are sending out resumes, and there's this one person who's walking around like the cat that just ate some cream cheese, and she's cool. And I said, so what, have they made a deal with you? No, they haven't said anything to me. Wow, you're pretty cool for somebody that's, And then I was at work yesterday and my phone rang and it was her number. So I said, oh, hi. No answer. So I left a message. I said, hey, you just called me. What's up? She didn't return my call. A few minutes later, it rang again. I picked up the phone. Hello. And I hear her talking to my boss. They are in a car. They're driving somewhere. Oh, I wanted to listen. I wanted to find out. What's the scoop? What's the gup? What's going on? What's the dope? What can I use against them? Can I file some kind of lawsuit? They're doing something. Oh man, the 10th step. Thank God I work very closely with an Orthodox Jewish woman, and she's good friends with me. So I went next door. I still had the phone open because my character defect was saying, listen, find out, listen. But a power greater than myself took me to the next room, and I said, hey, Miriam, guess who's on the phone, and they don't know that they can't hear me, but I can hear them, and I want to listen. And she just looked at me and she said, so are you going to? And I said, no. That's the 10th step for me. It holds me accountable. It's really so easy for me to practice these principles in an AA meeting. Oh, you should see me with my son at 5:45 in the morning. I used to hate kids like him when I was a kid. Because I'm trying to get his math done before I leave at 6:30. He spent 20 minutes, aggravating me. Yeah, he has fun. What means, come on, Daniel, come on, please. And he'll mess with me for 20 minutes, and in exactly 3 minutes, he'll finish the whole page of math. I'm done. Every morning. So that's why I need a 7th step. It's not easy being married to another recovering alcoholic, because every instinct says, take her inventory, tell her, go call your sponsor. That's kind of problem. But life is good. It's challenging. I don't know where God is going to send me. I've had 4 or 5 different calls for jobs in the last few days. I'm really grateful. I want to end on a note of gratitude. Because when you Americans figured out how to do this stuff, you didn't keep it to yourselves. You put this down in a book. And you sent this book out all over the world. And as we sit here right now, there's 106,000 meetings with 2.2 million people listening to some joker like me sharing experience, strength and hope in 46 different languages in 181 countries. AA is in more countries than Coca-Cola. That's power. So what is to me, what is AA about? AA is about two things. It's about God and it's about booze. And one's going to kill me and the other is going to keep me sober. And I have talked a lot about God. And you should get this guy. You talk about God. Get him out of here. He's going to scare the newcomers away. No problem. Booze will scare the newcomers right back in. The AA program says, stress the spiritual feature freely. I do not have the power to stay sober. It's only the grace of God and the power of God and the glory of God and the love of God and the wonder of God that has allowed me to stand here sober today and tell you that AA works. And to thank you Americans, I'm American through now, but thank us Americans for sending this program out all over the world. If I took too long and if I didn't cover any steps, I'm sorry, you'll just have to invite me back again. Thanks.